Play to Potential podcast.
Welcome to the seventh conversation of the Play to Potential podcast series. This is Deepak Jayaraman here, the creator and curator of this series of conversations. In terms of background, I'm an executive coach, and I work with senior successful executives and help them navigate phases of high-stakes transition effectively. My guest this time is Abhijit Bhaduri, who's a leadership and a digital transformation coach to CXOs and senior business leaders. He's a well-known keynote speaker, a voracious writer in leading journals and magazines, including the Wall Street Journal, and is one of the leading HR influencers in social media, according to SHRM India. I also discovered that he's an amateur cartoonist and has appeared in a Bollywood movie, Apna Asman, and has appeared in plays in India, Kuala Lumpur, and the US. Professionally speaking, he's held senior HR leadership roles in companies like Wipro, Microsoft, Pepsi, Colgate-Palmolive, and Tata Steel. Given the digital wave that's hitting us from multiple directions, I felt leaders could benefit from his perspectives on the digital tsunami, which is the title of the book he's just written, and how we could deal with it effectively. Without further ado, over to the conversation. Abhijit, thanks for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And congratulations on the launch of the book and the success of the book, Digital Tsunami.
I don't know whether it's, you know, success is a very loaded word. I'm not sure any book is really that successful. But yeah, I mean, I think I appreciate the fact that people have read it. And it's encouraging for a writer.
Maybe a good place to start, Abhijit, is let's start with the book. Give us a sense of what you mean by Digital Tsunami and why you wrote this book.
So I initially thought that the book would be called The Digital Mindset. And the reason why I thought so was because, you know, I find that a lot of companies actually invest a lot of time and energy in the technology part of it. And so they will invest in, let's say, the right kind of software, the right kind of stuff to make the company's business model at par with the digital requirements. But I also noticed that a lot of companies do not actually do enough to change the culture inside the organization, because the digital world is going to require some very, very fundamental shifts, many of which are almost polar opposites to how we have been used to working. So what happens is the organizations automatically assume that, you know, we are going to move into a model which is going to be very efficient. But people take a long time to change. I mean, think about how hard it is for us to keep up to New Year resolutions. Mm-hmm. And here we expect that, you know, the entire organization is going to take a New Year resolution one day, and from the next day onwards, we'll never falter. That's actually probably not very accurate. So I wanted to draw attention to that aspect.
And what are some of the dimensions of polarities, to use your term?
For example, if you think about, you know, the analog world and digital world is what I've contrasted with. So the analog world is a lot more siloed, you know, mm-hmm. whereas the digital world is boundaryless. You know, people, if you think about how software today is written by some of the, you know, the big five in the digital world, which is typically your Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google kind of businesses.
Sure.
They actually have cross-disciplinary teams. So you will have an anthropologist, you'll have a behavioral scientist, you'll have a coder, all of who will come together and design the website. You know, right. Or you're creating a product, you will have people of all kinds, you know, very diverse teams. So transdisciplinary and borderlessness is a very fundamental principle. That explains why, you know, companies, the ones that I mentioned, it's very hard for us to actually figure out what business they are in. I mean, right. So what business is Google in, you right. know, and why on earth is Google competing with a Ford and General Motors at one level, and maybe a completely different biotech company at another level,
sure.
and then, you know, working with maybe, you know, contact lenses and diabetes and medical
sure.
devices and all of that. I mean, this boundarylessness is the essence of the digital world.
Got it.
So and this is hard for analog companies to manage.
And just maybe just sticking with the theme, what's the therefore for leadership? If for a minute, if we reflect on what does it mean from the mindset shift, to use your language, what are some of the themes that come up?
You know, the first thing is that leadership, one of the most important differentiations is in the analog world, the leaders were not very accessible, you know, so they would be accessible to a few people, and you know, they would show up for, let's say, some large public event kind of thing, public event or employee event, whichever way you define it, and they would, you know, pretty much come to the balcony, wave to the crowds, and then go back. I mean, this is pretty much the model, you know, symbolically speaking. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the digital world, the expectation is the leaders actually engage in real time with people, and that also means that the leaders are far less curated and polished, and you know, their leadership image is a lot less of that. It's a lot more about authenticity, real time. And this is very hard for people who've grown up in the older mindset, because they need to be seen as perfect when they come in front of the audience.
It's like the Pope appearing in the Vatican kind of a scenario.
Pretty much is the model that I had in mind. So this doesn't work anymore. People, you know, a consumer doesn't, if I have a problem with the airlines that I'm flying, then I would like the CEO to respond, because that may be the only name I know. If I were flying Virgin Airline, I would expect. Now, whether that is responded to by Richard Branson or not is really not the point, but somebody who reads that should be able to respond back. I think that's the immediacy that one is talking about, authenticity and all that.
It reminds me of I play the guitar. I mean, there's a lovely YouTube video of a guy whose guitar was broken.
United
broke my guitar.
That's right.
It's a wonderful song. Think about that. I mean, he brought the stock went down 11%, right?
Exactly. This is the power of the individual in the world that digital is creating. I mean, everyone is really a broadcasting house. So you don't have to wait for BBC to do a story on your company to be able to, you know, either take up the stock or take down the stock.
Right.
An individual employer, individual consumer can do that.
So let's go back to one of the themes from a leadership standpoint, Abhijit, which is hiring, right? Talent acquisition. Give us a sense of how that space is shifting given digital. How are companies innovating using digital to hire leaders at the top, both in terms of what they're looking for, the digital quotient or a digital mindset, and what are the technologies which are aiding better decision making from a talent acquisition standpoint?
Right, right. I think one of the polarities is that in the analog world, we didn't ever. While all the companies said that people are our most important assets or customers are king, neither of them was actually true. Mm. You know, in the real world, people didn't care either about employees or about customers. Mm. In the digital world, actually, it's just the reverse. That you have to put the employee or the customer at the center, and then build the rest of the organizational processes around it.
Mm-hmm.
So this actually is a very different mindset. So the way in which the process of talent acquisition works is that you hire people not for competencies, mm-hmm. but you hire people actually for their ability to learn stuff. So competency is the old analog model, where you have a world which we know, which we understand. There's a defined path. So the roads are already created. You just need to have people who know how to navigate those roads very well.
Right.
So it is really like being a bus driver. Mm. So you should be, it's a school bus driver. So you have a particular route. It may be very crowded, very complicated.
But it's a predictable set.
But now in this digital world, you are really looking for the cabbie, and who will be able to pick up vague directions, when they train cabbies in London, they actually put them through a couple of years of training, and you should be able to give them a very random street landmark or something to that effect, and say that, oh, there's a pub which is known for the fries that they do, and there's a laundry, which is right next to it, which has got a funny name. I think it's the name of a movie. And that's the place where I want to go. The person should be able to actually take you there.
Great point, actually. It's almost like a different set of skills, not just how well you drive the car, but how well you're able to navigate.
And build the conversation with the client, being able to engage the people. It's a very different set of requirements. In the digital world, there is no precedence.
Mm.
So what happens is this, the world is going to be made up of people who know how to create roads rather than drive on roads which are already created. Mm.
And to your point, how do you test for learnability? What's been your experience?
Most people who are curious, have at some point of time picked up stuff which they've tried to learn on their own. I just was speaking, half an hour back to a person who's teaching a class here in this particular organization. They're actually teaching someone how to run a particular software. And I said that, that's very impressive. How did you learn it? So he says that, no, I've never attended any class, but, you know, I used to listen to all these people talking about it in the online forums. Mm. And then I would go and try out the different things. And then, you know, as I experimented, I discovered that, you know, I could actually figure out many different options. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people would post screenshots. I would look at them and sort of try. I've met so many people who've picked up, you know, you can't reach expertise level,
sure,
but you can pretty much get way past average, which means you're pretty much at the other end of the bell curve. Mm. So I think it is possible for people to do that. However, one must also then say, while it is possible to sort of, let's say, go from 0 to 85, you know, by learning on your own, then there is another aspect which actually takes over beyond that. When you want to really take it to the real realm of expertise,
okay,
then you are looking at feedback, deliberate practice, and all that stuff that makes people move, crawl up from 85 to 100,
right,
then that's a very, 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 very slow climb.
True. True, and it's a pretty long climb. I mean,
it's a very long climb.
It's in the realm of 10,000 hours and all that stuff, right?
10,000 hours of deliberate practice, which is so hard. Yeah, it's so hard.
True. And moving to a different theme, Abhijit, which is about personal branding, right? Again, you briefly spoke about leaders being on stage 24/7, right? What are your, and in a lot of ways, we are leaving our digital fingerprints all over the world, right? Whether it's social media handles, whether it's our surfing behaviors, whatever those might be. So what are some of the lessons to be learned in personal branding, specifically in the digital world? What do you see some of the good leaders do?
Actually, the first thing is, you know, I would say that as compared to the analog world, the digital world places a colossal amount of premium on authenticity and transparency. You know, we are in a connected world. And so what happens is that, you know, it's very hard to sham and fake what you are not. So, for example, I have no clue about sports. But if I were to, you know, say that, okay, this person scored a goal, I'm just so excited, I'm a fan of this guy, it'll look extremely fake because the whole world knows, at least all my friends know, that I have no such capability, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to fake things. On the other hand, you know, when you are online and you're responding in real time, it's sort of, you know, there is a possibility you'll make errors, you'll make typos. You know, today I put a doodle out and said today actually happens to be Einstein's birthday, you know, and then instead of March, for whatever reason, fat fingers, I typed it as May. Mm-hmm. And somebody said that, okay, you know, so why are you wishing him 2 months in advance? And I said, oh my God, I made that mistake. And so, you know, first of all, to be able to acknowledge and immediately put it out saying, I made a mistake, guys.
Sure.
And instead of trying to explain and say, actually, you know what, it was a typo, but then what happened was because I think sometimes when you're trying to type this, autocorrect will change this.
I know what you're saying.
No, never do that. You just have to acknowledge it was a bad move. It was, I was careless. I should have looked at it before I pressed post, and I didn't. Mm. So I made an error. The moment you acknowledge it, actually, that's the other amazing thing. For all what you hear about, you know, people getting hammered online, I mean, actually, the audience is extremely generous if you acknowledge your mistake and say it was really, you know, it was a judgment error. And people are, you know, fairly forgiving. They stop doing that. What people don't like is somebody trying to justify and then, you know, trying to act clever and wriggle out of the scenario. That just people will gang up and ensure that they have a view. So I think it's a different set of norms.
And I think it goes back to the same point about authenticity, in the sense if you're sincere in your apology. And
it is like really big about being authentic and just do what you really are. And so personal brand, well, you know, a lot of people could get fame, but fame and personal brand are two different things. I mean, you want to be able to craft the personal brand. Fame or lack of it is not necessarily something that... Fame can come from multiple things. When you make a really big boo-boo, it could, you know, give you that 15 seconds of fame.
Sure.
For example, you know, there's this BBC video of somebody who's an expert in Korean affairs. He was actually giving an interview, and his kid actually walked in. That video has been seen 84 million times, you know, in that one
and
day.
Nanny taking the child.
No, it's actually not nanny, it's his wife.
Oh, is it so? Sorry.
Yeah. So then, you know, just to be able to acknowledge that and you know, and their life has got affected by them, what happened with them.
If you look at some of the things that went viral, like the Cola Very D song or whatever, right? It's just sometimes it's hard to figure out what makes that happen. But again, back to personal brand, how do you think about it? Again, there are different channels, there are different platforms. In your head, how do you think about leveraging some of these platforms, whether it's LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, whatever else you might be on?
Right.
Is there a certain method to the madness here?
I would think that there are a couple of three or four different sections to this. One is to be able to, I think personal brand is really about self-awareness. You know, the more you are able to get awareness about yourself, I mean, whether through your own reflections, you know, looking at your digital footprints or behavior footprints, I would say, seeking feedback, you know, talking to people and getting that kind of a feedback. All of that actually helps you understand what am I really, you know. So what are those two or three signature strengths which I can put out there which is going to be useful to people? This latter half of the sentence is extremely important. You know, you could be really great, but if you are out there to toot your horn, people very quickly learn to ignore you, you know. So you have to do something which is going to value add to people. People, attention is precious.
Yeah.
Even for you know, 140 characters, people want you to say something which is meaningful. So therefore, to say that great weather today in Bangalore, I mean, okay, good for you, but then, you know, it doesn't excite anyone to know that. So I think it's a lot of that which, you know, you have to keep in mind. So there is a self-awareness. Second thing that you need to look at is, what is the content that I'm going to write about, which I care about enough so that I should be able to write about it incessantly for a while. You know, and by incessantly, I don't necessarily mean 400 tweets a day. But even if you're putting out, let's say, one or two things that you are looking at, you're posting on Facebook or whichever social media platform, Instagram.
Something I can stick with.
Yeah. Something that builds an association that, okay, you know, here is a person who will write about, you know, let's say sports. You know, are you going to write about sports? Are you going to talk about tennis? Are you going to specifically talk about how to become a good tennis player, or are you going to talk about how to build, you know, a great forehand? What is that niche that you're looking at? So it's about that. The third element is, you know, platform. Mm. You know, very rarely do you find someone who's extremely popular, let's say, on Facebook, you know, is equally popular on YouTube or is equally popular on LinkedIn or whatever, you know. So I think because each of these platforms actually has a different grammar, and until you are able to figure out that grammar, it's very hard to connect to people.
So you want to point you make and double click on the word grammar for me. What do you mean here?
For example, you know, the world is actually going extremely visual. So are you able to, you know, and that visual means different things in Instagram, you know, with all its filters and all kinds of things. There's a certain language to it. Snapchat has its own filters and there's a immediacy and then it's gone and it's all of that. So there's a certain grammar to posting that, you know, there's a certain set of rules and do's and don'ts. There is no place where you can learn, but you can observe other people who are really doing it very well and then actually learn from that. So that's another piece. LinkedIn has, when you're writing a blog post, you know, a certain length works well, a certain set of words works well, a certain way in which you structure your statements works well, the way that you write your you know, title of the article actually has a bearing on how many people read it. So it is, you know, so the more you are able to experiment, the more you are able to figure out the nuances and say, okay, I think I have some kind of an idea about what works and what doesn't.
Okay. And I think you were talking about four things and you've done one, two, three. Was it a fourth?
Yeah. So I was just thinking, so there is self-awareness, there is content, there is the platform. And the fourth one would be, you know, frequency. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to be consistent. And this frequency is really around what do you kind of think about which is going to be a feasible thing for you, where whether you're traveling or whether, and by and large, unless you're on your deathbed, I mean, what is the kind of frequency that you can manage without feeling overwhelmed? Because a lot of times, you know, people will start to post things with great enthusiasm and they're posting like 10 things every day. And then after 3 days, they sort of give up. And then for like 1 month, you've disappeared. It doesn't work very well in the social media. So you have to start only when you're mentally prepared that even if it is twice a day, you know, I'm going to do that consistently. I've been posting pretty much once a week on an average for past 11 years on my blog, you know. And wow. Sometimes it is hard because, you know, you're traveling. But what I do is if I know that I'm going to be traveling, I'll schedule it because you can do all that today. So if I know that I'm going to be partying somewhere on, let's say, over New Year's, I could always, you know, 10 days before write a New Year post and put it there,
Program
it so it'll appear sharp at midnight. So sometimes people say, well, I mean, how crazy is this that you, instead of, you know, celebrating somewhere, you're blogging. And actually, I'm not. I'm actually, it's posted there. So those are the simple things that people who blog will tell you in a moment. And there are millions of articles which should tell you how to do it.
Got it. I want to move to a different theme, Abhijit. And we are in Bangalore. I'm curious about this whole startup ecosystem. And as the companies grow, clearly there's a point where there's a need for gray hair or no hair, as I call it, right? For people with experience to start coming in and leading chunks of the business. What are some of the lessons to be learned on managing this transition well, right? For this set of people who come from, not everybody is coming from the analog world, but a lot of these people who have brick and mortar skills trying to settle into a company which is young, which probably is sort of growing in the digital era with a bunch of people who probably speak a different language and are from a different generation. So any commentary around what are some of the themes that emerge in terms of handling these transitions well so that they don't become points of fracture?
You know, I think most of the time, if you look at the startups, and this is fairly universal, which is, you know, you cannot think of having a startup without, let's say, a technology person, you know, somebody who's the CMO, or somebody who's looking at security, somebody who's the CFO. I mean, you know, one could sort of go on with that list. But it's pretty common to find companies who do not have a CHRO, you know, and most of the times, if you look at, you know, you talk to the founders, the best case scenario they say is it's so important I do it myself, which is of course really like saying that, you know, I think surgery is very important, I'd like to do it myself, you know, it's really saying something to that effect. Most people in the startups, when they fail, they do not fail because, well, of course they fail because they don't have a great product market fix. But the ones which make it past that stage, you know, they inevitably, you know, face challenges which are driven by the fact that they haven't focused on the softer issues of building an organization, which could be, you know, the way that you've designed the org structure, the way that you've designed the leadership team capabilities, the way that the kind of org culture that you're building. And some of the largest unicorns around the world, you know, today, if we are looking at it, I mean, they face challenges which are really around culture. They're the softer issues, which are about what kind of values are we going to hold people to. Now, the moment you actually make those choices, it changes the trajectory in multiple ways, because if you say, I'm going to have these values, these are the ones which we are articulating, these two or three things that we think are core values for the organization. When you articulate something like that, you know, parallelly, you have to ask yourself, would I be willing to let go of a candidate who is extremely competent? We need just those skills. But that person does not display these values that we have identified as critical. If that were to be the case, how would we deal with it? And most of the times, these are things that we haven't thought of. So we say, okay, you know, this time we'll make an exception. We'll coach this guy, but get this guy on board. The moment you start doing it, you have to ensure that you have to be aware that you have sort of let go of a very vital piece. And the implications of this are not visible in the short run. And therefore, most people do not understand how serious an error it is. And, you know, they realize it only when there's a crisis. And there are enough examples of companies in the world which are very successful otherwise, which have had this kind of a challenge that, mm-hmm. you know, they've had challenges of culture, which is how it explodes, you know, because of either a harassment suit or, you know, it could be about the way some senior official has behaved in public and all of these things. And later on, many of these people have turned back and said, I need leadership help. I need someone to coach me. I think I need to grow up. I need to be mature. These are all the words people have used. But this is something that you need to do, not after you've hit a certain benchmark in terms of turnover, which is how people look at it, that these are luxuries we'll do once we hit a certain turnover or scale. These are things you start doing the moment you're hiring beyond the original lot of people who started to form the company. And that is very hard because, you know, now you're saying that, okay, first of all, nobody wants to join me. Now if I sort of sift out people based on the values, etc., and all this fuzzy stuff, then, you know, how am I going to ever run the business? And that's exactly where compromises start to take place.
And talking about leadership development, and coaching clearly is a part of that equation. How has that shifted with digital, right? In terms of the approach that people take, but also in terms of how companies are using digital to drive more effective leadership development. Any views on that?
So I think there is, you know, in when we are talking of digital examples here, keep in mind that there aren't that many great, successful examples of companies other than the ones that I mentioned. In digital, these companies are pretty much the benchmark for pretty much everything, you know, in the way that they approach the market, the way that they groom and train people, their org structures, and many of the things, you know. So I think that's one piece that I want to put across. But fundamentally, the possibilities that digital throws up is, I think, massive. I mean, for example, you know, you could have a chatbot to provide just-in-time feedback to a manager who's doing a certain set of behaviors which you're trying to coach the manager on. There's kind of possibilities of leveraging something like augmented reality to build skills of people. You know, some of this is actually happening. I mean, there are clinics in US which use Singapore, US, which are actually using augmented reality to train medical professionals in the work that they are doing. You know, automobile companies are using augmented reality to teach people how to fix, repair, and maintain stuff. So some of it is happening, but it's probably not mainstream. If you look at, you know, video in its different forms, and when I say video, I'm actually using a wide range of technologies that I'm going to club under this term video, which is like even augmented reality, virtual reality, I'm going to put under video.
Sure.
It's a moving image, you know, if you were to sort of boil it down. The ability to use virtual reality to build even soft skills, you know, to help people build empathy. I mean, these are things which are today possible because of technology. And so I think that's where it will go. So learning is going to actually shift like that. At this point of time, you know, pretty much we are in the first minute of the day as far as creating opportunities for people to learn using digital tech. So I don't think that anybody has got a massively, you know, evolved model yet.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think it will go is that, you know, the foundations will get driven by machine learning, or, you know, artificial intelligence, which is actually going to help people find patterns and coach them on very specific things. So you do find, you know, there are startups and companies which are working in this space. They are building the products and they will need the help of large companies to be able to create those data sets through which they can train the machines. So I think if the large companies paired up with the smaller companies, that's really the sweet spot where you can do something really creative.
Interesting. Interesting. I want to move to a different theme, Abhijit, which is about building a digital mindset. And I think it's a non-trivial shift for leaders, right, who've spent a lot of time in the analog world and some who've spent half the time in the world and, you know, have grown with the emergence of digital. And when I say this, at least in my head, there are two, three themes, right? One is about how do you stay productive and how do you take in information given the deluge, given the tsunami, right? That's sort of one. Second is managing time in a digitally distracting world, right? Just back to the point about deep work and mindfulness and deliberate practice. And then just staying current, right? Just given the number of moving pieces, how do you really stay on top of these things? Those were just three things that occurred to me. But I think as I think about this digital mindset, I guess it's almost like a multidisciplinary shift, right? Which feels like a big order. So in your head, from a habit-changing perspective, what have you seen some of the leaders do, both in terms of how they've approached it strategically, but also even in terms of tactics that have worked well for them to really shift the needle from the analog mindset to the digital mindset?
So, you know, I was talking to a leader yesterday who has just sold his company to a healthcare startup. And, you know, this is the sixth startup he has sold.
Okay.
And his clients range from Microsoft of the world to Cisco and now this healthcare startup.
Yeah.
And then, I was asking him that, what are your interests? And so this person is actually an engineer from IIT Kharagpur and has deep interest in classical music and archaeology. And he's spent time, you know, going for those excavations and all kinds of things and picks up stuff on his own. So I was asking him, what do you read? So he says, I read about 60 articles a week. And then I try and sort of plow through about four or five books at a time. And then, you know, we finish off different books at different times. So I said, so what are you reading now? And it's pretty amazing. The person's reading stuff which is ancient history. He's looking at a book on machine learning. He's looking at a book on photography. There was, I think, another one he mentioned about music. This, in many ways, encapsulates the kind of mindset that we are talking about. You know, for somebody who is, you know, very comfortable with the polarities. So, you know, when I look at... If there was only one symbol which describes the digital world, I would use the ampersand, you know. So when I started my company, Abhijit Bhaduri and Associates, I used the ampersand because in my world, in my opinion, the world is going to move to an and world, you know. It's no longer you're either a science person or a liberal arts person. You are actually going to have to be both, you know. So... yes, you will have to understand analytics, perhaps, but you will also need to be able to tell the story of the insight that you got using analytics. So, or if you don't have every skill possible, which is, you know, more likely to be the case, you will be able to work very well with people across divisions, you know. And that means not only people inside your organization, but in a seamless manner to be able to also work with communities, talent communities outside. All of that is actually the mindset that is going to be extremely important. So you're looking for people. I think the new leadership paradigm is going to be driven by two core values. One is actually having the humility to ask a question and say, I really don't know, tell me about it. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. And you could ask that for anyone, regardless of the person inside the organization, junior, senior, peer, anyone. You know, so humility is one. Number two, having the courage to be able to fail as you are learning. You know, it is not the world, because if you look at what prevented people from taking to social media, and by that I mean, you know, leaders of large companies, because they for a very long time believed this is some child's play. This is something meant for teenagers and it's not meant for serious people like us. We are not supposed to be doing all this. Mm. And suddenly you realize that the new language of communication has evolved.
Mm.
And those people who did not sign on to it, who kind of thought that, you know, is one of those frivolous things that somebody who has a lot of time on their hand. I've heard like so many people say that.
Mm.
This is for people who have all the time in the world to
and
do.
It comes
all
from
kinds
the either
of
or
things.
Paradigm, right?
It's and the either or that, you know, I don't need to do this.
Mm.
But the reality of life is, and so, you know, when I'm still one of those leaders in a very large tech company, the person actually turns back and says that, you know, what I mean is I have a day job. So now when do I get on to you know, something like social media and do all this stuff. And I'm saying that, well, the company has an internal social network, so you don't forget going outside. What do you do? So he says, no, that is for all those youngsters, you know, the 25-year-olds who we have in abundance. It's a tech company. The average age is 25, 26.
Right.
So he said that it's for those kind of guys. And, you know, they're talking about all kinds of rubbish there. And this is the mindset which comes from the analog world, that, you know, youngsters are the frivolous characters who have all the time to do
I'm beyond all this.
I am the busy guy. I'm the big guy. Therefore, I'm supposed to do, you know, all the things that really matter. So I have to worry about profitability. Without realizing, it is that youngster whose work is going to drive profitability. How do you engage that guy? And most of the people, actually, one of the biggest chasms I see in leadership learning and mindset is the fact that most people do not realize how large this new medium is, which they have ignored. And it's, I don't know, at the risk of sounding really negative, I think it's too late to learn. You know, because it just is a very different mindset. For example, you know, if you look at Facebook and look at the emergence of video, people consume something to the effect of 100 million hours of video every day on Facebook. Contrasted with something like Netflix, people are consuming 16 million hours of video every day on Netflix. This is pretty amazing. It sounds like a massive number until you think about the fact that on YouTube, people are consuming a billion, and that's spelled with a B and not an M, billion hours of video every day. So if this is the language, if this is the medium where people have moved already, I mean, if there's a billion hours being consumed on YouTube, you know, there's a very large proportion of people who are doing, going by the fact that not everybody is consuming the video 24 hours a day.
Sure.
Even if they consume, now you can do the math and figure out if people are consuming, say, 20 minutes of video every day or 1 hour of video every day, how many people, you know, the massive number that we are thinking about. This is the point. How many leaders know how to communicate and engage the audience using this new medium? And very few companies are actually teaching it. Again, if you look at all the digital companies or digital-born company, I should say, especially the leaders, you know, the Amazon, the Googles, and this and that of the world, are actually encouraging all their leaders. Those are some of the few companies which are encouraging their leaders to abandon print and everything else and move to video with the idea of engaging them. This method actually reflects the mindset change. And for many people, this is very, very hard. Because they've never, you know, in the social media, the first thing that it teaches you is you have to earn your spurs. You could be any CEO. It doesn't guarantee that people are going to listen to you unless you have something to value add to people.
Yeah.
So, and one of the people who I was sort of interacting with, and he said that the CEO, he said that I've started my Twitter account, you know, a couple of days back, and, you know, I've told all my team members to follow me, but, you know, beyond that, nobody is joining. I mean, you know, what do I need to do to get a million followers? So I was saying that, what have you been posting? So he says, you know, I've posted the fact that I'm out for a game of golf. And, you know, so why should somebody care about it? Why should a million people care about the fact that you are playing golf today? It's a massive event in the lifetime of humanity.
It's also at some level it's also a equalizer or a level
of course
of playing
it
phase,
is
right?
Because you know, when you say things like that, you are living with an inflated self-image. You have to realize that you are not that interesting, that, you know, a million people are going to spend time listening to your statements.
And even that's a learning. How do you come across as credible and value additive
this is about humility, right? I mean, to be able to. And I've seen people, you know, like last year, it saw a major shift in Facebook usage by CEOs of companies. I mean, people with the likes of Indra Nui have come on board, and they're actually really trying to learn, and they are grounded enough to tell people, I don't really know this, I'm trying to learn this. And people then go out of the way to actually teach them, and they say, you know, you should do this, read up this, I'm sending you this. I mean, but the moment you kind of say that, okay, I know it all, and then people say, okay, go right ahead and show me the chops. I think that's the place where we begin to lose the audience.
But just maybe wearing a coach's hat, if we talk about where does one start? Again, getting maybe a little tactical here. What's been your approach, or what have been your thoughts on just triggering this shift, right? Yeah, I mean, one is understanding that there's a different world out there. Second is recognizing the polarities and the and world. But really, how do you start moving the needle?
I think the first thing to do is to build it around your daily routine. You know, I don't think you can. This is not a world where the rules are documented. Therefore, you will attend a 5-day class and then you're coming back completely prepared to face the world.
Right.
This is a place where you'll have to really learn to carve out your own sort of road, dirt road. And that means, creating forums. And I've seen people who will actually, in their office, spend lunchtime every day with a different person trying to learn something. It's really once you start demonstrating that curiosity and you actually build it into your routine, that every day you are picking up something, you know, it's a part of the way that you operate. You read something online, you post something online, because this is the other thing that a lot of people believe, that if I were to just lurk around, you know, on Twitter or, you know, Facebook or whatever, any platform, I'm not even going to mention Snapchat, because most people beyond 30 do not understand Snapchat, you know, so... whatever be the platform that you're looking at, and even if it is not necessarily through social media, just to be able to, you know, get a bunch of people together and try and have conversations. Learning today in the digital world is through conversations. And that conversation, the more wider, you know, technology platforms are really helping you connect to a very large audience.
Right.
So it's just that, you know, in as much as when you distributed prints of photographs, you could only do, you know, a finite number. You could do 100, 200, 500. But today you can upload a digital photograph and a million people can see it in like a couple of seconds. So This opportunity to scale up, now you may not be able to learn from a million people at the same time, but, you know, if you curate the ideas well, and you will be able to actually start getting excited about the language. It's really about learning a new language. So you learn the alphabet first, and then you kind of really try and form small words, and then you kind of get onto sentences and do that. So it is the same principle that would work. Right. Trying out different things on a sustained basis, whatever takes your fancy. Pick a subject that you are deeply passionate about and try and teach that to people. So social media is not just about getting, you know, a lot of people kind of look at that as a megaphone. Now that I can potentially reach 3 billion people, then I'm going to really use it like a megaphone and announce my presence. It doesn't work like that. Two, it's not a medium to speak to, it is a medium to listen. It's a medium to learn. It's a medium to teach. So you learn the fastest when you try to teach people something. You know, because that's
and
one
what would
place
be an example that teaching in the social media.
You know, for example, if you look at some of the most popular YouTube stars, and by that I don't necessarily mean the paid the stars who have got like 50 million followers. I'm talking about the average Joe who's sharing his or her interests in life. It could be you're a great cook, share a recipe. You've learned a particular skill, share that. You know how to draw. Teach us how to do it better.
Right.
You know, help me become better. That's the value add you can do to me. Or you're a business leader, you understand a sector and a particular industry very well. Help me make sense of this. Why is that company doing ABC? Put out a commentary. I mean, can you become someone like the John Oliver of the business world, let's say in a particular sector? Or maybe at least even of your company, even if you don't want to do it on Facebook, can you do it internally in the company, you know? Maybe hold a weekly conversation. Just say, this is so-and-so person's view of the last 7 days as life has unfolded.
Correct.
You may start off with only 2.5 people in the room, but believe me, once the word of mouth happens, you will run short of room space.
And I think it goes back to the earlier point you made about showing up time after time after time, right? So sort of the consistency.
A right. brand is about consistency. Right. You know, you don't do one thing today and then, you know, wait for 6 months and then do something else. Right. Nobody notices.
Right. I want to talk about CDO, Vijit, Chief Digital Officer. That's a term that comes up quite often. I talk to some of my search consulting friends, and clearly it's a role that a lot of companies are hiring. How do you think about that? I mean, and what mistakes do you see people making as they think about this role, Chief Digital Officer? Is it one person that should play the role, or is it a mindset, or is it a combination of the two?
You know, I think what having a particular person in charge does is that it puts a little bit more of attention and resources that the company needs to invest in. Yeah. So there was a point of time where, so let's say when an organization creates a chief learning officer,
right.
It's a misnomer to think that chief learning officer is the person who becomes the one person who understands it all. Absolutely not. But what it does is, can the person build the ability or the excitement and belief in the organization that all of us can be our own CLOs, you know, so you can create your own methods of learning, you can experiment, you can create content, do all that. That, I think, is the role of the CLO to be able to facilitate. So in the same breath, when you are talking about having a CDO, the CDO's role is to actually create the culture in which the nuances of the digital world are understood, you know, creates awareness of the board. Let's say on things like cybersecurity, there's very little until you understand what that could possibly mean, you know, and the kind of impact of that on the brand, on the talent, on various things. It's very hard for you to actually craft a strategy around that. And a lot of times, you know, the board may have people who are not necessarily that familiar with the shifts in the digital space. That's the kind of education. So in many ways, the CDO, at least in the initial stages, is going to be educating people about really the impact and possibilities and scope of the shift and talking about how to navigate that.
Hmm.
So the CDO today is really the map maker of this new world.
And for a minute, if I were to go back to my past and wear my search consultant's hat, in terms of what would success look like for a digital officer coming into the company, what are the kind of things the person would demonstrate in a 12 to 18 months or maybe a longer time frame from an outcome standpoint?
So I think the first thing is, you know, I'll go back to my term that it's an and world. So, you know, you will have the analog and the digital coexist.
Right.
And, you know, we talk about a two-speed world, that there is the traditional business as usual and there is the, you know, the new world out there which is emerging. Over, you know, so most organizations will go through the transition where you create the new world and, you know, maybe in the first year, your revenue coming out of the new world, you know, the digital world is only going to be single digits. And there's going to be a point of time when, as this grows, you know, it is going to replace the old model. And that's the kind of transition, except for the fact that in the case of the digital shift, the time to make that happen is like incredibly crunched. One way to sort of look at it is if you think about, you know, sort of the growth of the e-books, you know, and Kindle and all of that. I mean, go back 5 years, 7 years, and you'll sort of see that there was a point of time people said, this is a fad. I mean, who will ever not want to read a paperback? And, you know, there's a tactile feel to it, which is true. I mean, you know,
when digital cameras came in, right? The people said,
exactly the
I want
point
to feel the photograph.
I want to feel the photograph. And what happened to that? You know, so there are millions of people. So it's a habit which is being formed.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, habit forming takes time. Adoption takes time. But in the digital world, it's so easy to form the habit.
Yeah.
You know, also think about it, you know, about 5 years back, if I had said, will you put up your photograph on a website which millions of strangers will look at? And most people will say, absolutely not. I love my privacy. And look at what people are doing today. We are sending our photographs all over the space on WhatsApp and like a million other devices and a million other platforms. And think about the fact that we are leaving behind digital footprints which we are not even aware of. And the other day, I was chatting with one of the senior leaders who said that, you know, I'm extremely particular about my digital footprint, and therefore for me, privacy is of supreme importance. So I asked him that, did you ever have a profile on Orkut, you know, which is the older social networking site?
Yeah.
And he said, yes, I did. And I said, that, so what happened to that profile? He says, gosh, good that you reminded me, because I haven't used it in 4 years. I think I've forgotten the password. And this is the whole point, that, you know, there's a truckload of photographs you've got there, connections, data point, this or that, conversations, all of which remain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we forget the one time you wanted to get a deal and you sign up and put your email address there and you create a password which you repeat somewhere else and then you repeat it in a more important site. All this is exactly where, you know, the world is going. So it's a new world which we will have to get used to, and we'll have to learn the new grammar.
Got it.
But I don't think we have a choice.
Sure. There's clearly a... inevitability sounds fatalistic, but clearly there's a possibility there, right?
Totally.
For all of us to grow into. Shifting gears, Abhijit, I want to talk about building careers, right? And I read your book, and I found two or three themes quite interesting. I'm going to weave them and would love your perspectives. One is about commoditization of expertise, you talk about it. Second is about being perpetual beta, which you talk about. And third, which really I found interesting, was sort of moving from a T to a pi.
Right.
In terms of how you build capability. But just your commentary on two things. One is, how should people think about careers, and how's that paradigm changed in the world we are in?
Right.
And second is, how do people think about staying relevant,
yeah,
given the
right,
number of moving
right.
pieces?
So I would sort of start by saying that, you know, we have moved from a time when people stayed in one company
right.
over their lifetime. That was my dad's generation, and they kind of stayed in one company and never changed. And that's how the world was. It was a far more stable, predictable world. Then, people like us who actually started off in one company and moved through different employers. I've moved through several employers and sort of done that. And we are now going to head to a time when... individuals are actually going to hold multiple jobs, the one individual we employed simultaneously with three or four employers, and then there is going to be another disruption, which is that skills are going to become obsolete very quickly, and business models are actually going to go out of the window very quickly. You will come to a scenario where most people will get forced to shift out of a particular company, a particular career, and they will hop through careers. So they will actually, you could be a software programmer one day, and then as that skill becomes obsolete and you sort of are no longer the price commodity in the market, people will switch maybe and run a coffee shop somewhere, and then maybe pick up another skill and learn music and teach music somewhere for a living, and then come back and learn the latest language, and then maybe come back to something else, or maybe teach history somewhere. So the ability for people to navigate through careers is actually going to be driven by the people's ability to learn many different things. The more you can learn many different things, the more opportunities are going to come for you. And the more you're going to get hung up about, so I have to wait to be certified and coached and do all that. I think it's going to be very hard for people to live with that paradigm, because those options will reduce dramatically.
Hmm. And specifically, your views on moving from a T to a pi, are there examples where people done it well?
You remember I was talking about this individual who's an expert in machine learning and
right.
Has got an interest in archaeology and loves classical music and, has dreams of writing a book. This is pretty much, people who can live in that and world, the polarities, that they can sort of, they're as comfortable talking about artificial intelligence and machine learning as they are about discussing, the nuances of great fiction.
It's not even a pie, it looks like an octopus, right? In terms of just the number of...
It's actually the fact that, you have one leg of the of that symbol, As interesting, you're talking about it because yesterday was World Pi Day, actually. And so you have one leg which is, you know, straight. And the other's got a little curve there, which in my mind is, you know, the piece which is you learn about many different things so that you are able to use your expertise in that other depth area across many different contexts. So, you know, this person, for example, you know, was talking about he's created apps. For the healthcare industry, he's done it a bunch of different times. And he says that it's insight that he has gained from his archaeology expeditions. And I was trying to figure out how is archaeology connected to building apps? And he then explained to me the principles that, you know, when you look at a site, how do you deconstruct something which you have no clue about? You know, so how do you sort of go to a particular site and then look at the artifacts which are lying there, you know, and then you say that you pick up something and say, what could this have been used for? Mm-hmm. What is the possibility? And he's saying that the important thing is to not get conditioned by what would I use it for?
Right.
What would somebody from a different time and generation have used it for? To be able to sort of, and that I think is the mindset which is going to thrive in the new world. So, and in a very, very blatant way.
And one of the points you touched upon, I think, is the gig economy, right? I think people are, as we move towards a world where the boundary walls are coming down, given technology is making coordination a lot easier and seamless, what's your advice to people in terms of how they think about committing to an organization and building a career there versus participating in the gig economy through a portfolio of things?
You know, I think the organizations, if they are able to leverage and get people excited in multiple different ways,
right.
You know, to the example that if when the person's ability to code is diminishing and being effective in that world and they're changing over to a different language altogether inside the organization, the same individual could be kept engaged. If I know that this person's really passionate about starting their own cafe, the person could start the cafe inside the organization. Now, this potentially is a frivolous example, but then, you know, people can move between adjacencies.
It's a great point to make about the need for the organization to listen as well to the aspiration of the individual. It's not just a standard path, right?
Yeah, because we assume that everybody who's an engineer loves to be an engineer. This
correct.
Is a mistaken correct. Assumption, you know. People have many different aspects. And I think this is the one big shift in the workplace, which is already happening, by the way, that the ability of the employer to encourage you to bring your full self to work.
Right.
You know, so the work, whatever you're doing, bringing in your hobbies and your passion and your interest and that little dream, put all of that into the work that you're doing today, whatever it is. And figure out a way to build that into the work that you're doing, I think is the definition of, you know, very successful careers or employee engagement. Employee engagement is not about celebrating birthdays of employees, which is, you know, how a lot of companies do it. Because they are like frivolous transactions.
True.
But if you are really able to, you know, engage people in teaching them different skills and keeping them curious, that's one of the biggest things about building people's engagement.
And appealing to their individuality, as you
Yeah, absolutely.
Lovely. That's great, Abhijit. I think moving to a few rapid questions to wrap up. One is, I think, students coming out of B-School, any headline advice on how they should think about the first transition that they're making from the world of studying to the world of being employed?
So I would just simply say that it's going to be a world where expertise and deep expertise is going to be valued. So it's not going to be about knowing one line of 500 different things. It's about knowing 500 lines about one thing.
Right.
So being able to have that expertise, people are going to value the person who has the expertise and then finds the context inside the organization to use.
Isn't that contrary to the breadth point we've been talking about? How do you think about that?
No, because, you know, until you build depth, breadth helps you to find different contexts.
Different applications.
But you bring in that unique capability to the workplace where you are better than anybody else, you know. So that's you're in the top 1% of that particular skill. the moment you have that, then you can play many different, you know, a great cricketer can play test cricket as well as, you know, T20 and something else in a different match format, day cricket, night cricket. All those are formats.
And judge a talent show.
And judge a talent show, I'm sure. Yes, so many people do that, truly. Yeah, it's all of that.
Three things they don't teach you at B school?
They don't teach you enough about working in teams and giving people feedback and still keeping your relationship intact. I don't think they teach you enough about using the new medium, you know, and people actually are still learning it by themselves. I also think that they don't teach you enough about the need to manage your career with a different set of rules, which the new world is going to throw up. So they're still sort of doing the same pattern which they have done for the last 50 years. So it's a horribly dead model.
And given we're talking digital, three apps apart from the usual suspects that have that you found extremely valuable in the context of what you do.
I love using the app for podcasts. You know, it sort of completely has changed the way that I learn. You know,
And this is you mean iTunes or Apple?
Yeah. I mean,
the podcast app. Yeah,
the podcast app. Mm-hmm. I use that a lot. I use LinkedIn the app a lot because it's sort of, you know, they now have short videos. I think that's a product which is still coming up, but it allows me to be able to publish on the fly, you know, so it gives me the freedom to be able to write a blog post even when I'm, you know, at an airport and waiting or some such thing. The mobile app is really terrific. I love that. The third one is, you know, I use a little app called, you know, it's for drawing and sketching. So it's the app which I use, and that sort of is something that I find very exciting. It allows me to paint and draw some stuff. It's not a it's an app called A-Sketch.
Okay.
And it allows me to do a little bit of illustration of whatever I add. So many of the things that you see, the little portraits done sometimes, and all of that is done on that app. So it's very useful for me.
Lovely. And just in summary, Abhijit, this podcast is titled Play to Potential, which is about individuals discovering their inner self and doing the best they can to play to their best. Any headline themes that you want to leave people with?
I think it's a terrific title for the AND world, that you have to learn how to play and explore your potential through play. So it's not just work. I mean, it's play which is actually going to tell you much more about where your potential is.
That's a wonderful insight, actually. I never thought about that when I crafted the title. But it's a wonderful spin on the whole title. But it's been a pleasure talking to you, Abhijit. And thanks for being generous with your time.
Thank you very much for having me here. I hope it was worth it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm reminded of the book Designing Your Life by Bill Burnett and Dave Evans of Stanford, where they talk about applying design thinking to sort out your life. This is based on an eponymous course they teach in Stanford. They suggest that you take stock of life across four dimensions. One is work, which is what all you do, including what you get paid for and what you don't get paid for. Second is play, which is what gives you energy and what gives you joy. Third is love, which is who are the key people where you want to have meaningful relationships and how does love flow in and out of those relationships. And health, which is a combination of physical, mental, and spiritual. The crux of what they say is that the key is to harmonize across work and play so that it's sustainable and is fun. Hope you found it purposeful. For more, please visit audioboom.com and look for Play to Potential. Look forward to having you in one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast series. Bye now.